I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Alan Cahan, professor of British civilization at the University of Versailles, St. Quentin. We're discussing his recent book, Freedom from Fear, An Incomplete History of Liberalism, from Princeton University Press. Cahan's research is on the history of liberalism, particularly in the 19th century. He is the author of several books on John Stuart Mill, Alexis de Tocqueville, and many other figures, as well as a translation of Tocqueville's Old Regime and the Revolution. Well, first of all, Alan Cahan, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for inviting me.
Alan, I love this book. Sweeping history of liberalism. The adjective that comes to mind is magisterial. So it's a great wide coverage. I recommend it to anyone who's trying to learn about the history of liberalism. Thank you for writing the book. Let me ask you, though, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
Well, to be honest, I did not set out to write a history of liberalism. So the original title of the book was one of the sub-themes, namely the three pillars of liberalism, freedom, markets, and morals. And the reason I was going to write that book was that I got increasingly annoyed by so many contemporary descriptions of liberalism, or of that horrible pejorative neoliberalism, which seemed to imply that liberals thought only about economics, or at most about economics and politics, and that liberalism had never had any kind of moral, even religious dimension to it. And as anybody who has studied 19th century liberalism knows, whether we're talking about European liberalism, American liberalism, any kind of liberalism, that was wildly at variance with the truth. So I was going to write a book about the forms of liberal rhetoric, liberal argument in the 19th century, and how they typically relied on the three pillars of freedom, markets, and morals, or politics, economics, and morality and religion. But in the course of writing what was going to be an essay of perhaps half the length of the eventual book, I realized that I couldn't really talk about this without writing history of liberalism. And that in the course of talking about these arguments, the conception of liberalism as freedom from fear formed in my mind, as it were. And this led to the book expanding into what it's become, which is to say a history of liberalism from the late 18th century, really, to last week.
That's great. And maybe you could just start us off by saying a little bit about how your, because there are other histories of liberalism that are out there. Helena Rosenblatt, for example, has written a recent one. But you could say a little bit about how you see your history sort of contributing, to the various histories of liberalism.
Well, I learned a great deal from Helena's book. It's a wonderful book. It's a book by an historian written for historians, whereas my book attempts really to straddle both history on the one side and political theory on the other. So I'm making an argument in terms of political theory at the same time as I'm attempting to arrive at a certain kind of historical understanding and description of liberalism as an historical phenomenon. That's not what Rosenblatt was trying to do. The other thing that differentiates me from her book is that we both have this common stress on the moral religious element of liberal language for most of the history that's central to it. I am making a sort of framing argument in terms of fear and a particular kind of chronology and the history of different fears that have dominated liberal thinking, and finally making a sort of, not exactly predictive because it's merely a hope rather than a prediction, but a normative claim and a political claim as to how liberalism will have to change from its late 20th century version if it's going to be successful in the 21st.
Yeah, my sense from some of this is that, you know, when thinking about liberalism, sometimes political theorists tend to focus on, yeah, to say the 17th century, 18th century, that is before the word was even coined, which makes a certain sense, right? If you're like looking at Machiavelli or looking at Hobbes, looking at Locke, I mean, there are clearly strands in these thinkers that are very useful for thinking about how then liberalism ultimately develops. But just to be clear, I mean, you know, you focus, I mean, you have a chapter on some of the precursors to liberalism, but a lot of your focus is in the 19th century and after. I mean, I don't know if you want to say a little bit about that. I mean, in terms of, I mean, it makes sense to me to start when liberalism was sort of like coined and had its actual political heyday. But in terms of, you know, the choice to do a little bit later, I guess, than the usual.
Sure, there's a lot to say about that. So from the viewpoint of the history of political thought, right, talking about something before there's a word for it is a little bit problematic. And so liberal became a politically descriptive term very much in the aftermath of the American and French revolutions. You'll still find in some textbooks the idea that the first use of the term liberal is in 1810 in Spain, when there's a liberal party that's formed. That's been pushed back by more recent scholarship. Now you find usage of the term liberal as a sort of anti-Jacobin, but also anti-royalist perspective in 1790s France. Clearly, the thing, liberalism as a response to both revolution and reaction, is around before the word is coined. It's in existence, really, once the American Revolution has happened. And so that's when it seems to me fair to start talking about liberalism. But certainly, some of those characteristic fears that liberals are combating, the fears of fanaticism, especially religious fanaticism, and so on, and the notion that everybody should be safe from the fear of the moment, is around since the end of the wars of religion. This is a point that I do agree with Judith Schlar about, although we disagree on many other things, even though I did borrow my title from her. But then again, she borrowed it from Montesquieu. And so there is what I call proto-liberalism, which is a common phrase in France, in the period after the wars of religion. Now, why do I start with Smith and Montesquieu? Here again, there are historical reasons. Although it's going to come as something of a shock to many American scholars, particularly people in politics departments, past 10 or 20 years have really established the complete irrelevance of John Locke for the history of liberal thought in the 19th and early 20th century. And this is as true in the United States as Arsenis's recent book demonstrates for America, and it's true in England and on the continent as well, as work by Duncan Bell and Timothy Stanton, and even a little bit by myself for this book has shown. People just don't talk about John Locke in 1850. He's just simply not there. And on the rare occasions they mention him in terms of political thought, it's to completely dismiss him as an outdated medieval kind of political thinker. Now, this is not to say that the Letter on Toleration does not have some principles of interest for liberals today, or that you cannot find elements in Cicero or Hobbes or Machiavelli that can be made use of in a liberal context. But in terms of looking at the kind of things liberals worry about, and the kind of things liberals see, as really being influential on them, you're not going to be able to go too much before the wars of religion, to at least as far as I'm concerned, to find liberal having any terribly useful role to play. Certainly, you know, freedom in the broadest sense is around in Western and non-Western traditions, for that matter, for a lot longer than since the wars of religion, but a liberal understanding of freedom, that I would say no. And one of the interesting stories, at least as far as I'm concerned, that's told in the book, is indeed to see how Locke, having been a very important figure in the 17th century, having disappeared from really the mid-18th century until 1900, let's say, suddenly became important again, especially after World War I and even more after World War II, largely for political reasons that existed on the left and people who were against liberalism, socialists like Howard Lasky found it convenient to label Locke a preeminent liberal, and later as the C.B. McPherson, because they wanted to associate liberalism with possessive individualism. And at the same time, figures on the right, like Friedrich Hayek, who wanted to firmly attach liberalism to what he saw as a purely Anglo-American tradition, as opposed to those evil, nasty, dangerous continental traditions, also found it useful to adopt Locke at the head of their genealogy. And of course, Lewis Hartz in the 1950s made this an American orthodoxy. Although if you'll go and read the reviews of Hartz, you will find that while the political scientists loved him from the very beginning, the historians hated him and did not believe that story. But Locke, by the 1950s, became what I describe as the zombie Locke, returned from the dead to dominate the scene, a scene from which he'd been absent for 150 years.
Yeah, I mean, at least part of, I think, the case for Locke has to do with the development of a kind of social contract theory approach to liberalism, which, of course, yeah, inherits from Hobbes, a way to ground political authority or legitimate political authority. I mean, I guess you get, you know, liberals like Kant, for example, working, you know, sort of translating that social contract theory tradition. But I mean, I guess on the social contract theory point, I mean, and some of the apparatus that Locke uses, would you say that some of that apparatus becomes less important in the 19th century, or it
not really less important, but it's seen as dangerous. Because social contract theory is so strongly associated with the French Revolution, liberals do their very best to forget that anybody had ever discussed it. But even before then, you know, Adam Smith is pretty dismissive of social contract theory. Kant is not. But once we get past 1815 or so, it's very hard to find anybody who's doing social contract theory. And again, that is going to begin to change, but only in the 20th century. So that's another reason why Locke gets put in a box and locked away for a long period of time.
I mean, and this is, I think, one of the most useful parts of your book. I mean, there's a whole world for those who sort of associate Locke with liberalism and social contract theory with liberalism. There's a whole wider array of types of arguments. So let's get into the architecture of your book. So as I read it, you know, there's essentially, you sort of categorize liberalism and the history of liberalism from the 18th century to the present in terms of four fears and three pillars. So the fears are the series of fears that liberals in the different iterations of liberalism respond to. You could say liberalism 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. It's great. So there are four sets of fears, which we'll talk about as we get through. And then there are three different pillars. That is, as I understand it, sort of the means or mechanisms that reliably liberals have turned to in order to allay or address those fears. And those are some appeal to politics or citizenship, some appeal to markets or economics, and some appeal to morals, or as you pointed out, morals or religion. So I thought maybe we could just start with those kind of, you know, the fears and the pillars. I mean, the book is called Freedom from Fear, which is redolent of Judith Sklar, as you said a minute ago, but broader than her approach. I mean, we could say, just start by saying a little bit about why you take fear to be central to liberalism, which is a little bit surprising. I mean, one might point to, for example, liberty is central to liberalism, but and fear is something maybe sort of broader than liberalism, that all political orders might address fear in some ways, as Hobbes, for example, might expect. So why fear?
Okay, several things. Several people have brought up to me the idea that, you know, all political ideologies seek to protect people from fear. And in some sense, that's true. But the difference is that liberalism tries to protect everyone from fear without deliberately setting out to make some population afraid. There are a whole lot of ideologies that want some considerable portion of humanity to be afraid. Sometimes it's the rich who are supposed to be afraid. Sometimes it's the poor. Sometimes it's the people of the wrong religion, the wrong skin color, the wrong gender. There's a whole lot of illiberal thought in that sense. And by thinking of liberalism as the ideology, the movement to create a world free from fear, in fact, you're saying something that really does distinguish liberals from a whole lot of other people and gives you a fairly handy yardstick by which to distinguish the liberal from the illiberal, because the illiberal too often claim to be defending freedom. But it's a freedom that's predicated on the fear of a certain group of people. Without that fear, we can't be free if we do not suppress, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of the reasons why, in fact, I landed on freedom from fear. And the second is that if you effectively leave Sklar behind, because for her it's the fear of a sort of historically undifferentiated cruelty, you can see that the changes in liberalism over time, which are pretty apparent at a glance, have been in responses to the particular problems the people of that time were facing, the particular things that they were, in fact, afraid of. And indeed, if you look at 19th century liberals, there's a particular Latin phrase that you will find repeated almost ad infinitum, that we're trying to avoid Scylla and Charybdis, right? This old Homeric simile of the dangers on the left and the dangers on the right, and we need to steer the ship of state down the safe ground of the middle. And left and right, revolution and reaction, both of which can lead to cruelty, massacre, despotism. The sort of primordial fear of liberalism is simply arbitrary power, but that fear takes very particular forms in times and places. And so I found the notion of liberalism as freedom from fear to be really a very useful way of conceptualizing both the change in liberalism over time and of distinguishing it from other groups. Besides, I was looking for a very long time for a one-sentence phrase that would both mean something to the average person and actually say something meaningful in an academic sense. And this is the one I finally came up with. So it, in fact, I think, does say something significant as well as historically and theoretically defensible.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think one of my worries about fear is central to liberalism is you might think that fear, you know, a political regime that seeks to reduce fear also might seek to reduce liberty, right? Because liberty sometimes can be kind of tumultuous and sometimes can create kind of chaos. And so sometimes liberals, especially the sort of more freewheeling ones who want to resist appeals to stability and order, security, you know, the real anti-Hobbesians, will, you know, Hobbes is on the side of addressing fear, and you address fear by creating a strong central order, for example. So, yeah, I mean, what do you think about that worry in terms of fear being sometimes maybe in conflict with liberty?
Oh, well, you know, Isaiah Berlin made the point that, you know, all laws are in fact a restriction on liberty. But at least the good laws, laws against, let's say, you know, murder to start with something. In fact, you know, you can look at this in a Benthamite utilitarian sense. They reduce the greatest amount of fear for the greatest number. Or in a perfectionist sense, that they allow us to pursue or encourage us to pursue all kinds of positive goals, which we can't do if we've been murdered. So that's one kind of angle of response. The other is, I know there are people who call Hobbes a liberal. I've always thought I would be really not terribly, I would not think myself terribly free or free from fear to be living under a Hobbesian autocrat with only my life perhaps to be protected. So that doesn't really bother me too much, if you like. Now, in terms of, oh, well, you know, we're going to eliminate one particular fear at the price of, you know, all kinds of, you know, horrible repression. Well, I think this is, it's not too hard to distinguish the liberal and illiberal versions of this for all practical purposes.
Yeah, you might, right. You might create huge government surveillance and clamping down on liberty in order to address the fear of, I don't know, Islamophobia after 9/11, but then you create the fear of a, you know, huge government state. So liberals seek to
And
balance,
Muslims as a
yeah.
particular group are singled out for those of whom we are
Right,
afraid and whom we
right,
are
right.
going to make afraid, which makes precisely is what makes that an illiberal kind of measure.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes sense. No, that's useful. So let's talk about the pillars of liberalism. You talk about politics, markets, and morals. You want to say just a little bit about sort of, you know, each of those pillars briefly, and what are the some of the examples that sort of fall within them?
Well, so first of all, of course, not every liberal thinker talks about all three of those things, even in the 19th century. And even those who think that all three of those things are necessary will may spend, you know, the vast majority of their attention talking about something else. So, for example, James Madison says that without a certain amount of virtue in the people, no form of government can be stable or free, but the Federalist Papers are mostly not about virtue, right? We talk about factions, we talk about various kinds of mechanisms that do not rely on virtue, even though Madison himself acknowledges the necessity for a certain amount of virtue and, for that matter, of religion in order to have a free people. Ditto, there are a few comments in Madison in which he says, you know, what Smith has to say about free trade and the wealth of nations is obviously correct, and so on and so forth. But again, he says, spends very little of his time actually talking about economics. So what I am not claiming is that all liberal thinkers of sort of a mainstream sort do all of this equally. What I am claiming, though, is that not all. There are some notable exceptions, people like, say, Bentham or Bastiat, but the majority of mainstream, ordinary 19th century liberals do, in fact, acknowledge that all three of these elements are crucial if you want to build both a convincing argument for liberalism and a stable liberal state and society. You're going to have political elements. In the 19th century, that mostly meant some kind of constitutionalism. You're going to have a free market, essentially capitalist society, because private property is essential as a basis, again, for making people free from fear. This may strike some socialists as an odd argument, but I nevertheless think that it's a correct one. And you're going to have a moral and even a religious basis on which to found your society, because one of the things liberalism is both intended to encourage for these people and relies upon is a notion that progress is not just material, it is also moral, and that liberalism is both the precondition of making us better people, not just happier or wealthier people, but is also a part of being a better person. Again, this takes lots of different forms. For some liberals, political participation, for example, is an absolutely essential part of being a better person, whereas for others, it's mostly a guarantee against intrusions on your freedom and not itself a particularly or necessarily important part of your personal spiritual progress. So both of those things coexist within the general three-pillar view of liberalism. Again, never unanimous. Bentham really doesn't give a damn what your morals are or what your religion is. He's absolutely sincere when he says the children's game of pushpin is as good as poetry. And he goes on to say that it's an impertinence to distinguish between good taste and bad taste. It's simply your taste and we can't say anything about it. John Stuart Mill and many other liberals would have regarded that as absolute nonsense. But Bentham's there. Bentham's important. Bastiat is all about the economics. And he says, yeah, there's a sort of higher form of morality, but I'm just not going to talk about that. And it's basically irrelevant. It's the purely utilitarian growth of the economy. That's what matters. Or you have a Herbert Spencer who says it's all about evolution and that's it. So these one-pillar liberalisms, liberals who want to stand on just one foot or sometimes two, as opposed to a more stable tripod, are always there. But in certainly until the 1870s, what I call until the end of the short 19th century, and even until World War I, through the fin de siècle, liberals whose arguments at least gesture in the direction of the importance of all three of these pillars make up most liberal thinking. It's only post-World War I and especially post-World War II that people whose thought is purely political or purely economic tend to dominate the liberal scene, and in particular, moral and religious language disappears from most liberal discourse.
Yeah, in fact, I found this discussion useful also because it helps account, in my mind, for some of the differences among the disagreements within the liberal tradition, with which there's considerable disagreements. I mean, your analytic framework of thinking about the different fears that animate liberalism is useful in bringing out those differences. So modern liberals who fear the problem of poverty will engage in disagreement with classical liberals. But there's also the way in which, you know, if you focus on different kinds of pillars, you're going to generate different kind of downstream views about what's important to you know, structure your politics and economics. Is that one of the, I guess, functions that you had in mind with thinking about this, you know, this framework?
To some extent. One thing I want to make clear is we have a particular way of envisaging traditions of political thought, genealogies, trees. And I think both of these are a really bad way of thinking about traditions of political thought, because it leads you to think that there's a growth in one direction. There's one particular, you know, main line of the eldest children, or the direction of growth of the tree, and there's main branches and there's subsidiaries and so on. My image is the oyster shell. Why oysters? First of all, they're much tastier than trees. Second of all, when you look at an oyster shell, you can see all the different layers at once, right? No layer disappears. They're all there. At any given time, you will find liberals who are still more concerned with some previous problem, you know, liberals in 1900 who just never got really interested in poverty, or liberals in 1950 who aren't really thinking about totalitarianism much, or liberals who are really into one set of arguments as opposed to another. So they're all sort of contemporary with one another, even if there is a topmost layer that is the one that's most visible at any given point in time. But otherwise, yes, I think generally speaking, what you've just said is correct. And it's a way of seeing the shifts in liberal thought and liberal action. So that by the time you get to the 1880s, for example, everybody's got a constitution. And revolution and reaction seem to be not eliminated entirely as problems, but receding. The threat of, you know, socialist or anarchist revolution. Well, yeah, anarchists still set off bombs from time to time, but it doesn't seem like it's actually going to happen. On the other hand, all of a sudden, liberals start talking as a point of historical fact about, well, this problem of poverty. That's a big problem. And even if as a proportion of society, there are fewer poor people in 1890 than in, say, 1820, which is the case throughout Europe, for that matter, the United States as well, the problem has become very different because now in 1890, we're much wealthier. We think we could actually do something about poverty. Whereas in 1820, if you distributed all the money equal, we just all be poor. Now we have much more money. And now we have new techniques, new technologies. And we think, well, instead of fearing the poor because they're likely to be revolutionaries or religious fanatics, now we realize that, poverty is something to be afraid of and that it limits your freedom in all kinds of ways and makes you afraid, not perhaps of somebody coming to torture you, but of someone coming to pull you out of bed, not for the purpose of taking you to the dungeon, but for the purpose of, you know, you haven't paid your rent, so you're out on the street. And we get this great split within liberalism between the people who begin to call themselves classical liberals themselves in that period. It's a contemporary term in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900. And then people who go by lots of different names. I call them modern liberals. In America, they're the progressives. In Britain, they're the new liberals. In France, they're solidarists. In Germany, they're social liberals, but who now want to use the state to do something about poverty. Not necessarily the national state. The Jane Addams type of American progressive is very much into, you know, local government being mobilized, but not the national government. That's why she votes for Herbert Hoover in 1932. But some attempt at building what would later be called a social safety net in ways that rarely occurred to liberals before that time.
That's great. So let's get into your history. I mean, you have a big history, as I mentioned before, and you talk about many, many different thinkers. So this is going to be I think your book is called an incomplete history of liberalism. So this is going to be an incomplete discussion about an incomplete history of liberalism. So I'll just have to ask you to, you know, when you illustrate these different periods, you know, pick which ones you think are most illustrative. So you start with proto-liberalism of the 18th century. We sort of already, you know, mentioned this. Sort of Montesquieu and Smith are your main figures, or, you know, fantastic figures to illustrate it. The fear particularly that you focus on here is the fear of religious fanaticism and despotism. And that these thinkers employ all three of the pillars that we discussed. So, I mean, they both have a clear fear that are animating them, and they have all three pillars. And if you want to sort of expand, you know, so draw some examples from these well-known figures to make your point.
Oh, well, very, you know, briefly, the simplest way, let's take Smith, right? So theory of moral sentiments, our moral pillar, the wealth of nations, our economic pillar. There would have been a political pillar. There are the lectures on jurisprudence. There's some gestures towards this as well in The Wealth of Nations, but not as fully explored. Classical in this regard. Montesquieu, the spirit of the laws, discussing in depth here both the politics and the morals, honor versus virtue, the way in which commerce relates to these kinds of things. So economics as well, very much a full three-pillar discussion. And one of the reasons I pick these people, in fact, is because, you know, some of these 17th century fears earlier on, they're in a really quite different kind of world than the world of the American or French revolutions. Well, Smith and Montesquieu, they're already beginning, they're more recognizably our contemporaries in ways in which Locke, at least if you pay serious attention to Locke, Locke is not. And so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to start with them. I mean, I don't want to go through the list of all the figures covered in the book, but if you don't mind, I will shift in a certain sense, because the book is not just a series of sort of, you know, short intellectual biographies to illustrate this or that point. At various points, I stop talking about individuals and give a chapter devoted to where the rubber really hit the road, how liberals dealt with very particular kinds of problems at certain periods. So, for example, there's one chapter in which I discuss liberal attitudes towards who should vote, liberal attitudes to nationalism, and the immense and immensely ignored phenomena of liberal anti-Catholicism in the 19th century, which in many ways tells us a whole lot about liberalism and populism today, because it's how do liberals deal with this set of illiberal attitudes that just won't go away, even though liberals really thought it ought to, right? Catholicism ought to have disappeared. So are many of the attitudes of populism today. And yet, damn it, they haven't. So what do we do about it? And what we mostly do about it is throw hissy fits in the 19th century, just like we do today. And that's chapter is set in the short 19th century. There's another chapter talking about the relationship of liberalism and colonialism, liberalism and feminism, and liberalism and the radical nationalism of the late 19th century, and how liberals in practice dealt with this. Again, with a lot of analogs to today. But it's all of this in order to show how liberals are very much always responding to the problems of their time, as we'd expect them to. I'd be delighted to talk more about anti-Catholicism if you feel like asking a question or two about that. But one other thing that I think has been greatly ignored is the huge role that the end of ideology movement of the 1950s and 60s played in the liberalism of the later 20th century. So for those listeners who might not be familiar with it, there's this worldwide notion after World War II that what really got us into trouble, what really made everybody afraid, were ideals. Fascism, communism, passionate commitment to any political ideal was terribly dangerous. This is not just an idea of intellectuals, right? I'm a great fan of the mystery novels of Dorothy Sayers, in which Peter Wimsey is the leading character. And at one point, he's talking about ideals, and he says, if an ideal is a real ideal, the first thing it starts to do is kill people. That's a very much end of ideology attitude. And so in the 50s and 60s, we have people on both sides of the Atlantic saying, look, let's just drop ideals. Let's replace them with expertise. So you can, you know, of all people, you can find great examples of this in John F. Kennedy's speeches. We think of him as the great idealist. But in fact, he's saying, we don't want to talk about ideals. What we want to do is have a little, you know, really good experts, professional tinkers with the economy, increasing all of our GDPs and spreading the wealth. And let's just talk about that. Let's debate who has the best kitchen with the Russians, not who has the best idea of freedom, as Nixon and Khrushchev famously debated about kitchens and so on. And it became pretty clear by the time we get to the late 1960s that ideology isn't dead. And so this became, instead of a description of a fact, it became an aspiration. And that aspiration took the name of, well, let's appeal to value neutrality. That's really the end of ideology movement turned into both John Rawls and Robert Nozick without anybody really noticing that that's what happened. And so they are creating a neutral state or society in radically different ways, but they're all part of this general flight from any kind of idealistic, moralistic, religious, God forbid, appeal in liberal language that really dominates the period between World War II and the end of the 20th century, which seems pretty successful until the 1990s in lots of ways. I mean, after all, there are no more fascists. Communism dies, and then pretty quickly falls apart thereafter. In part, the victim of its own success, people on the right who had been forced to ally with the liberals to fight the communists no longer have that problem after 1992. And therefore, liberals are faced with a situation that they're completely unprepared to deal with in our period, precisely because they had given up the kind of language, or at least such is my argument, they'd given up the kind of language which had once been commonplace among liberals in an earlier period.
That's right. I want to go back, but I can't resist following up here on the end of ideology point. So, I mean, because this, yeah, this is super interesting the way that liberalism develops towards a kind of value neutrality, and it's just like evacuating the moral component to it, the perfectionist element, as you put it also elsewhere. I mean, in part, and this is, you know, this is already explicit in Rawls. I mean, Rawls is, he's great on this point, that the development of liberalism in Rawls is in effect to apply the principle of toleration to philosophy itself, right? So if in the wars of religion, what we had were people fighting with one another about religion, in the 20th century, what you see is people fighting and killing one another about ideas, not just religion. So we have to apply toleration, not just to religion, but also to these ideas themselves, which means abstracting from the truth of any one view and actually achieving some sort of perspective of impartiality among them. And this is an effect of, you know, the sort of growing sort of pluralism, that the fact of pluralism that Rawls points out in the modern era. It's in a way hard to know what to do with that, other than to try to retrieve some sort of single value standard for a liberal regime, which then is going to be, you know, for a Rawlsian, necessarily exclusive of certain groups. But maybe that's the lesson for liberalism ultimately, in the wake of the sort of collapse of this end of ideology, is that you can't have a regime that just sort of includes all perspectives, right? It falls in on itself.
Well, let me answer that by a combination of appeals to Isaiah Berlin and the later Rawls against the earlier Rawls. Because Rawls himself retreats from this neutrality, right? There are people who think that political liberalism is merely the continuation of a theory of justice, but I'm of the school that thinks that that's nonsense, and that it represents, in fact, an enormous change of attitude, in which Rawls is admitting, well, actually, we're going to have to insist on a certain very limited moral pillar, certain values that we are indeed going to have to insist are part of our society. We can't be completely value neutral. But if you look at the fact of pluralism, as indeed Isaiah Berlin originally expressed it, it doesn't quite mean what people often think it means. First of all, for Berlin himself, there are limits. He says, you know, if in fact your opponent in the discussion is Adolf Hitler, the only thing you can do is shoot him. Toleration really isn't an option. This is, of course, a variation on Karl Popper's paradox of toleration, that if we completely offer complete tolerance to the intolerant, we risk seeing toleration itself disappear, which is not the goal of toleration. Suicide is not an acceptable way of performing liberalism. So there's certainly not going to be one liberal comprehensive view, to use Rawls's language, of the good life or the good society. There will be many overlapping such views, but liberalism has to have such views, or it creates the kind of moral vacuum which human nature abhors. So a liberal cannot simply say, well, the essence of my being is neutrality, because then the essence of your being is a void. And that's not very attractive. It's the problem of the utilitarian who tells the adolescent, great, you know, you're now free to do whatever you want without interference. And the adolescent says, that's wonderful. I love freedom. I'm really tired of my parents telling me what to do. By the way, you have any advice about what I should do? Because I haven't the faintest idea. And the only liberal response with Bentham is, no, I couldn't possibly give you any advice. That would be impertinent. Well, the adolescent is going to go and either devote their lives to video games or join a fundamentalist religion or something in between. But in any case, there's no good result there. Liberals have to be willing to put forth some set of different debating, but real visions of what human life ought to be like. That doesn't mean they should be exclusively perfectionist. One of my suggestions about liberalism is that liberals are often in alternate chapters, utilitarians here, perfectionists there. No reason, logically, this doesn't work. So much for logic. It's bad political theory. That is to say, if you are not illogical in this respect, at least it's bad liberal theory. And you can point to this in, let's say, Tocqueville, who has two tracks for how you have a free society. One is enlightened self-interest, purely utilitarian. And the other is the pursuit of moral grandeur, purely perfectionist. And successful liberalism, as I suggest, have to work on both of these tracks. Rawls did not, neither did Nozick, and look where that gets us. So I think that that's not the only part or the only thing that liberals need to do to deal with populists, but it's simply a necessary part of it. And among other things, what I'm not suggesting here, and one of my critics thinks that I am, but I'm about to write a reply to show that he's wrong. I'm not suggesting that, you know, all visions of the good life eventually converge in some happy least common denominator. We're all going to get along together. Isn't that going to be wonderful? No, we're not going to get along together. We all have different rankings of different values, as Isaiah Berlin put it. We're going to still have very different rankings of those values, but at least we will be in a situation where we can respect the fact that we all have values. Too often, neutrality is a rather thin veil of contempt for other people's values. And I think that a lot of populists have recognized that, that the people who say that they're neutral towards my traditional worldview in rural Poland or Peoria, in fact, aren't neutral at all, but in fact are completely contemptuous, but maintain their neutrality as a way of refusing to argue about values because they don't have a value-laden position, which is nonsense.
That's great. It occurs to me that, I mean, liberalism is, I mean, this is an understatement, a very complicated political view, right? I mean, as we've already been talking, there are four different spheres that animated over its history. There are three different pillars. And we're just talking now about how there's a perfectionist and a utilitarian sides to it and its ethical theory. I mean, it occurs to me to ask you, I guess, in this context, do you think that this sort of manifoldness of liberalism is an expression in its history of its strength, that is, in its endurance, that it's something that its complication helps it sort of internally survive and flourish in its internal development? Or is it something that's like a kind of weakness? That is, we were talking about sort of populism and the rise of sort of competing very, very simple ideologies where you sort of put forward something that's, you know, a kind of strongman view, very liberal, promises something. Whereas liberalism promises is kind of demanding on the both on the mind and on the political society. So does you think liberalism has historically been a source of its complication been a source of strength or weakness?
Well, both, right? That's the sort of inevitable answer to a question like that. Certainly, if you are running for political office, you better be able to have a pretty simple slogan in mind, like, you know, we want our rights, no taxation without representation. And at any given point in time, I think that liberals have, at least the successful liberals, have been able to narrow down their focus to what is really making people afraid and propose a liberal solution to it. At least the successful liberals have proposed a liberal solution to it that people have found convincing and that has in fact worked. At other points in time, liberals have been very, very muddled. So let's take a nice contemporary issue. Immigration, an issue that is important politically throughout the Western world at the moment. It's very hard to say what is the actual liberal position about immigration. There are lots of nice, simple, clear illiberal positions, but until there is a nice, simple, clear liberal position, not liberals are going to lose that battle every single time. So one needs to find a way in which you can articulate a position where neither the migrants nor those already there need be afraid. And how do you do that? I'm not saying that's simple, and I'm not necessarily a good politician, but for example, you know, put this in the American context. You have to have the traditional liberal battle against Scylla and Charybdis, the dangers from left to right. So on the one hand, how can we put this? To be anti-immigrant is un-American. We're all descendants of immigrants, except for those, you know, small numbers of us who are Native Americans, but for the moment, we'll leave that aside. And on the other hand, having no respect for the law, that's also un-American. It is, from this point of view, an illiberal stance to refuse to talk about illegal immigrants. I mean, the two things to avoid are illegal immigrants and undocumented immigrant people. These are both illiberal solutions to the problem of immigration, because I won't spend the time to go into the because. So you need a different word. You need to both have a liberal law and you need to uphold the law. And this is a liberal position. Fill in the details. But something of that sort gives you, I think, an idea of what I'm talking about when I say that liberals once again have to fight Scylla and Charybdis. They have to articulate a position in which no one need be afraid, in which rather than trying to oppose cosmopolitanism versus community, or try to make distinctions between nationalism and patriotism, which just don't work. See my history of liberals' relation to nationalism in the late 19th century when they tried to make exactly this distinction. And what did we get? World War I. It doesn't work. You've got to try to find a way to say yes, X and yes, Y, just as liberals have always tried to combine utility and perfection. So they're going to need to be able to combine community and cosmopolitanism, say yes to both of them in some politically effective way.
That's great. We jumped, I think, to the end of history in liberalism. I just have a few more questions. This is sort of wind us back to liberalism 1.0. We talked several minutes ago about proto-liberalism, but about liberalism 1.0. We don't have to go through the individual thinkers here, but I thought if you could, you know, sort of draw on a few examples to illustrate, I think what I take to be the sort of the crucial Scylla and Charybdis here for liberalism 1.0. That is, as you put it, I think, well, the fear here is both revolution and reaction for liberalism 1.0. But the thing is with the Scylla and Charybdis, I mean, liberalism itself has an appeal to the rationality of the revolution, as it were. It's not that this is sort of foreign to it, that there's an element of enlightenment, of course, in the liberal tradition. Similar too, that liberals have long recognized the importance of tradition and custom and the morality of custom. So it's, you know, how maybe you could talk a little bit about drawing some examples, how it is that liberals attempted to kind of steer between these two maybe successfully or unsuccessfully.
Okay, so one of the common ways of differentiating left and right in 19th century Europe is the party of movement, which is the left, and the party of resistance, which is the right. And so which party do liberals belong to? And the answer is, well, it depends on circumstances. Sometimes the illiberal position is we need change, and sometimes it's we must resist change. So liberals don't typically initiate revolutions, but they frequently join them in 19th century Europe. And as soon as they join them, what do they want to do? They want to end them. That is to say, right, we are going to join this revolution against the absolute monarch. And now what do we need to do? Write a constitution and put an end to the revolution. And thereafter, those who wish to overthrow constitutional government must be resisted, whether from the left or the right. Now, of course, in practical terms, the sort of original example of this is the history of the French Revolution. That liberals know, no, we do not want the Reign of Terror and the Jacobin, nor do we want the White Terror and the Bourbon Restoration coming back. So what do we need? We need a constitutional monarchy or maybe a constitutional republic. But in any case, we need a constitution which is going to set limits on the ability of the government to make us afraid and make it impossible for such a government to do that. And so we are going to contend for free speech in a sort of maximalist way against the absolute government. But once we are in power, yes, we are going to continue to defend free speech, but we're going to recognize the need for certain kind of limits. So for example, in practice, in 19th century Europe, a lot of liberal governments created a system in which there was absolute freedom of speech for books. You could put anything you wanted in a book. But newspapers, they had somewhat different rules. So for example, in July monarchy France, newspapers had to put up large sums of money as a bond so that if they were convicted in a court of libeling someone, or engaging in direct incitement to revolutionary acts, this bond would be forfeit, and so on. And we're seeing something of a similar debate going on today with respect to social media. And here we have a 19th century precedent to think about. Not that the situations are exactly the same, but you know, now that I come to think of it, requiring Facebook to put up a bond, when it, you know, spreads Pizzagate without doing anything about it might not be an altogether bad idea. I don't wish to suggest that terribly seriously, but I do wish to suggest that there are some really interesting continuities and parallels between the absolute need for freedom of speech and the need for there still to be laws about libel, which liberals have always suggested there needed to be, from, you know, John Stuart Mill on liberty or Benjamin Constant, equally so. And that liberals have always shifted between movement and resistance depending on what appeared to be necessary to preserve people from fear.
That's useful. You mentioned religion before. I wanted to ask you about nationalism, which undergoes a kind of shift in the 19th century, the sort of earlier part of the century. There's more of a possibility for harmony or marriage between a sort of liberals and nationalists, but it becomes much more vexed, in my understanding, in the sort of later 19th century. Maybe you could discuss, you know, sort of the challenges liberals had with navigating development of nationalism in the 19th century.
Sure. So let's say I'm in Germany in 1840. Essentially, anybody who said, I am a nationalist, would also have said, I am a liberal, and vice versa. In part because creating a united German nation seemed to be the only way to get rid of absolute despotism. Because otherwise, if you're in a small little German nation, you know, one of the 50 or so that exist at the time, either the Austrians or the Russians are going to impose despotism on you. And for the sake of any kind of freedom, you needed a united nation. And indeed, lots of other more positive reasons too. But that's 1840. Now we move to 1890, and things get to be rather different. So for example, I'm going to go backwards in time for a bit. One of my favorite examples, 1848, Frankfurt National Assembly. We're talking very openly about, look, in our projected Germany, there are lots of national minorities. There are people who have a couple different major religions, actually three. We got Protestants, we got Catholics, we got Jews. We have lots of people whose native language is not German in lands that we consider to be part of Germany. They speak Polish, they speak Czech. And we have people talking about, and I quote, non-German Germans, who nevertheless are going to be equally German with the rest of us, and who we should not attempt to impose German culture or even German language on, much less change the religion of the Protestants or the Catholics or the Jews. Sounds like the problem of, you know, non-European Europeans that we have today in Europe. Fast forward to the 1880s, and we have radical nationalists saying, non-German Germans, that's not allowed. You're a German or you're not. You're going to have one identity and wear only one hat at a time. Otherwise, it's not acceptable. Those nationalists in the middle of the 19th century did something really important for liberalism. That is to say, they tended to democratize it. They tended to spread it to everybody to make everybody's fears count, not just those of some educated elite, because everybody's a German, and therefore everybody's a liberal, and vice versa. But now we swing forward to 1880, and not everybody's a German, and not everybody's a liberal. And liberals begin to wonder about these illiberal nationalists and our relationship to them. And now we begin to fear the nationalist masses, whereas before we feared the reactionary and revolutionary masses. And in fact, all these begin to blend into one. And so we begin to worry about whether liberalism and democracy can stay married. One of the phrases of Julia Sklar that I like very much is that she says that liberalism and democracy is a marriage of convenience, but it's monogamous and divorce is inconceivable. Well, that's because she's basically an end of ideology theorist whose views are formed in the 1950s. Her first book is 1957. When you get periods like the present, as you did in the 1880s, we have increasing number of political theorists, Jason Brennan and a crowd of others, talking about, well, you know, maybe democracy's not all that it's cracked up to be. And if we want to preserve liberalism, we have to find ways of limiting the majority even more than constitutional protections of rights did in the past. And that's, in fact, a recurring liberal problem. And the relationship between liberalism and democracy, despite Julia Sklar's fondest hopes, is in fact unsettled once again. And just as much as I talked at some length at the end of the book about the need for liberals to develop a new moral and even religious kind of language, or at least acceptance of religious language, I don't talk about it so much in that book, but in my next project, I intend to. Liberals are going to have to think again about political structures, I think, because the ones that we have don't seem to be protecting us very well against illiberal democracy, which is doing quite well, as we all know.
Good. Yeah, I just have one more question about liberalism 2.0, which to shift to that, this is the late 19th century that we're talking about. We just started talking about nationalism and liberalism 2.0 in its context. And liberalism 2.0, as you point out, begins to expand the fear, not just from political forces, but to economic forces and the worries about poverty. You talk about Jane Addams, Leon Bourgeois, L.T. Hobhouse, a number of figures here. But I wanted to zero in on your, you mentioned this earlier, the way in which issues about colonialism come up, especially in liberalism 2.0. This is in many ways the sort of high point of European colonialism. There have been a number of political theorists who have talked about the implication of liberalism and colonialism in the 19th century. One might think of John Stuart Mill here, for example, and the British East India Company, et cetera. So you have a section on this in the discussion about a couple different issues that liberals had a challenge with. Maybe you could sort of expand on what sort of challenges did liberals face when confronting the problem of colonialism?
Okay, that's an interesting point. So first of all, let's be clear. Colonialism would have existed if there had never been such a thing as liberalism. There are some people who think there's an intimate connection between the two, but I see no evidence whatsoever that the desire for power is limited to liberals. There's a liberal colonialism and an illiberal colonialism. And this is quite clear in 19th century debates. And indeed, the idea of a liberal imperialism or a liberal colonialism splits liberalism. So in the book, I take as my sort of example of this, an 1898 debate in the French Assembly, where liberals are in charge. Jules Ferry, the great anti-clerical French liberal leader, is prime minister in the time. And it's a debate basically over whether France should conquer Madagascar, but everybody understands it as a debate over whether France should have an empire at all. And Ferry, in his speech defending the imperialist position, gives some illiberal reasons. We want France to be a great power. To be a great power today requires having an empire, period. But he also gives some liberal reasons for colonialism. And this is the so-called mission civilisatrice, the civilizing mission. Why are we justified in having colonies? Because these people are living in terribly illiberal circumstances. They are all subject to despots of one sort or another. By conquering them, we in fact will in the long run be increasing the freedom of these people who eventually, and here there's a split in the liberal imperialist camp, either will become themselves independent nations that are our equals, or else will become equally French with us. These are the associationist or assimilationist points of view, to use the name that's given to them in the literature. But in fact, Ferry gives three reasons for France as a colonial empire. The illiberal one, we need power. The liberal one, we need to bring liberalism to the world. And this is the only way it's going to happen. And a sort of funny one in between saying, well, we need markets. And the best solution here would be free trade throughout Europe. But since there is no free trade, since Europe has become protectionist, we need an empire for economic reasons. So that liberalism has failed economically in Europe. So therefore, we have to have as a second best solution an empire. Now, Ferry's opinion is fiercely opposed by Clemenceau, who says, you have no right to impose civilization on anybody. If they want to be liberal, they can be liberal all by themselves. And so his group votes against. How does Ferry win? By a coalition between his imperialist liberals and conservatives. Now that's in 1898. 5 or 10 years later, at least in France, the liberal opposition to colonialism has more or less collapsed. Right, Clemenceau is going to become minister for Algeria. And by and large, liberal anti-imperialism, although it is quite strong in the United States, in France, in England, and also in Germany, exists everywhere as part of the liberal tradition, it generally speaking loses. People are convinced at that point by the civilizing mission. And we may find that hard to accept today, that they could possibly have been sincere about this. I'm sure their motives were not unmixed, as human beings' motives generally usually are a little mixed. But it's, I think, a sincerely held position. And one that is not without a certain degree of resonance today, for better or worse, in all kinds of ways.
You know, Tocqueville is another figure who comes in this discussion about liberalism and colonialism. I don't know if you want to say a little bit about him. I mean, one of the interesting things about Tocqueville is he's, well, I think scholars for a little while thought he was a kind of unalloyed colonialist, but I guess I'm not a Tocqueville expert. My understanding is much more ambivalent about colonialism than has come to be. But in part of his ambivalence comes from, he's sort of excited by the possibility of the sort of grandeur that you were talking about. Colonialism can provide a kind of grandeur to France. But also, I take it there's some sort of pragmatic or practical worries about actually what would it involve in sort of governing Algeria in the long term, but also sort of deep liberal worries about sort of undermining the self-governing character of a people and making them dependent in a way that Tocqueville finds horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, Tocqueville's position is, in fact, I think, quite complicated. One of the things that he thinks of in a way that anti-imperialists tend not to, he says, okay, let me step back a moment. Tocqueville never in his entire life actually expressed an opinion either way on the French conquest of Algeria. What he did express an opinion about was that France, having gone into Algeria, should never leave. That was his view. In part, he says, because what would actually happen if we left? Would Algeria become a free and independent country? No, it would simply be conquered by another European power. So freedom is not actually an option on the cards for the Algerians. So under these circumstances, what should France do? He wants France to, in fact, create a settler colony in Algeria. He wants to do this. At first, he takes a very optimistic attitude. He thinks, you know, we're going to be very different from those racist Americans. We're all going to intermarry and raise happy multiracial children who will be good liberal French people, etc. He very quickly decides that, no, that's not really going to happen. And that we're going to have, you know, these Europeans and these Arabs and these Berbers and their three people, and two of them are Muslim and one of them are not. And he's very, very conflicted about the extent to which, while creating this settler colony comes with naturally all kinds of horrible massacres, that simply goes with the territory. We don't want to be as bad as the Spanish in the New World, or the Americans for that matter either, but we're going to be breaking a whole lot of eggs and destroying a whole lot of innocent people's lives, and that's just the way it's going to be, and that's inevitable. So you can see in Tocqueville this mixture of illiberal and liberal motives. And I think it's enlightening if you also contrast it with his view about the British colonization of India, which interests him at a number of periods in his life. He says again, look, India was going to be somebody's colony. Independence was not really going to be an option. It was too rich and too easy to conquer. Therefore, it would be conquered. But he complains to some of his British correspondents. This is during the Great Rebellion, to use one of its names, in 1857 in India against British rule. He says, look, you've really done much less than you ought to have to civilize India, to raise the position of the native inhabitants. Obviously, this can never become a settler colony. You've done far less for the Indians to prepare them economically and politically, et cetera, for eventual self-government. In fact, you've done nothing. And this is a great shame. So he too, on some level, shares some notion of a civilizing mission, while recognizing its complexity in dealing with people who he does not expect to really become Europeans or French. He doesn't see that as the possibility in Algeria after a very early period. And he certainly doesn't see that as a possibility in India. So in this respect, he shares this liberal dilemma about colonialism. And he's personally somewhat embarrassed about it, rather more embarrassed than John Stuart Mill.
That's great. Well, we didn't have a chance to talk about liberalism 3.0, which is a sort of 20th century iteration.
I snuck in a little about the end of ideology. That's part of
it. Yeah, we got it. And we certainly nailed that liberalism 4.0, which hasn't yet emerged, but it's your suggestions, which you've been bringing out here about what, you know, the direction in liberalism. So, but, you know, let me just tell readers that once again, that it's a wonderful book and well worth picking up and reading with great care. But Alan, let me thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
No, my pleasure. You're very welcome.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.